This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we bring you interviews recorded at Heli Expo 2017. And these aren't only of interest to rotorheads. There's something for everyone here. In the news, a Boeing 797 might be in our future. A hybrid electric-powered vertical takeoff airplane is taking shape. Companies attend the 2017 International Women in Aviation Conference looking to hire. Some post-merger developments for Alaska and Virgin America, and a flight instructor who really was not. Plus, we have a report on EAA at South by Southwest, and another memorable flight from a listener. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 443 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me is first Max Trescott. He's a CFI, an author, and our resident glass cockpit expert. Max West, how are you?
Hey, Max, I am awesome. We should just call each other East and West, I guess. Would that make it a little simpler?
Yes, it would.
How you doing there, East?
Waiting for the snow to arrive, which I here in the East, which I'm sure is not the case there in the West.
No, I won't talk about 75 degrees.
Oh, gosh. Speaking of the West, yeah. Also with us is Brian Coleman, our associate producer. Brian's back. Hey, Brian.
Hey. I was going to say, who are you guys and why are you calling me? It seems like I haven't been on this show since forever and, oh, geez, so sorry about that. But I did hear that the weather was nice in Pasadena, so I decided to come back and, yeah, it's 92 today. So
that's hot.
I'll shut up right now.
Man. Okay.
Yeah.
Just a quick note, sad note. David Vanderhoof's father just passed away. Our deepest condolences to David and Michelle. I know this is very difficult for David. It is kind of amazing. The AvGeek community has been expressing sympathy in a way that's kind of heartening. It's kind of nice to see, actually. And I know David appreciates it. All right. Instead of a guest this episode, we have a series of interesting interviews recorded at Heli Expo 2017 by our friend Launchpad Marzari, who has become our Airplane Geeks reporter at large. He's got some great conversations. It's not just all pure helicopter interest stuff, so make sure you stick around for that. But why don't we jump right into the aviation news from the past week? Is everyone ready?
Ready.
Ready from the West.
Our first item comes from the Seattle Times. This is by Dominic Gates, actually. Boeing's talking with airlines about a 797, and they like what they hear. Well, there really has been a lot of talk about a so-called Boeing 757 replacement, something between the single-aisle 737 in size and the wide-body 787. And it's been given different names. In the past, MOM is one of them, M-O-M, middle of the market airplane. We've also heard it referred to as the NMA, which could stand for either new mid-sized airplane or new market airplane. Well, we see in the Seattle Times piece that Stephen Udvar-Hazy, who of course is chairman of Air Lease Corporation, he says, call it a 797. That's what it's going to be. And apparently there's some interest in the part of, well, lessors, airlines, and maybe even Boeing.
Oh, don't forget us passengers. I'm definitely in favor of having a 757 replacement. Certainly hope that it's going to be a twin aisle. Flying across the Atlantic in a 737, I think, is nothing but pure pain. And I absolutely want a twin aisle for that flight. So I see this as a really good move.
The process is kind of interesting here. Typically what happens is internally in Boeing, They'll obviously work with customers, potential customers, kind of define what a new airplane might look like, or what features it might have, what capabilities it might have. But ultimately, they go to the board of directors and say, here's the business case for a new airplane, which the board might approve or might not. I think typically in these cases, the company going to its board does a lot of homework, a lot of analysis. So it's a pretty solid case usually by the time it gets to the board of directors. But we see here that Boeing may launch this plane as early as next year with an EIS, entry into service around 2025. So, Brian, you know, you get excited about something new, but then you come back to the realization that it takes a long time to develop, test, certify, and put these things into service.
Yeah, I might even be retired by 2025.
Well, I was just calculating this. We'll be talking about this again on episode 950.
Oh, that's great. That's
perfect.
Great. Hey, and I was kind of curious, what do you think they will do in terms of going it alone in terms of design and development, or outsourcing heavily on the design like they did for the 787? Obviously, I think they felt the trade-off was they could get it to market faster and that there would be lower risk on their side if it didn't sell. On the other hand, if it does sell, well, they give up some of the profit. So, yeah, I'm not sure the outsourcing worked quite as well as they thought it would. What do you think they would do on a 797?
Well, I think that they learned a lot of lessons with regard to supply chain, and by outsourcing so much of that work and having this pretty extensive supply chain. If something doesn't come together at the right rate or with the right quality, you have significant problems. And you have to decide very carefully what you're going to keep in-house and what you're going to outsource. But to answer your question, Max, I think that Boeing, again, I think learned a lot of lessons. So they should be pretty far down that learning curve. And risk sharing is fairly common because the risks are so great. You see that with the engines, for example, the 737 engines by CFMI. That's a joint venture with GE and SNECMA. Engine Alliance engines on the A380, that's a venture with Pratt & Whitney and GE. So you see these things fairly often. I think we'll see that again with the 787.
I'm guessing they didn't fully figure out all the costs and delays associated with outsourcing last time. And I almost wonder if they wish, given the success of the 787, they'd gone it alone and reaped more profit as a result.
Yes, yeah. I said 787 just a minute ago. I meant 797. Of course, but there's an interesting item in this article. Uvarhazy says that the key to this is a suitable engine in the 40,000 to 45,000 pounds of thrust range. And he said he expects that Boeing is going to offer a choice of two engines, likely one from GE, and here we go with another joint venture, and potentially one from Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce together. One of the things that I'm really watching for on this is major kind of design changes. As we saw the 787 develop, the A350, we saw advances in engine technology that make a big difference, and also with the 737 MAX, of course. But we didn't see some of the more advanced kinds of concepts, blended wings or engines that are blended into the body, or even open rotors, things like that. And I'm really curious to see, which of these more advanced designs ends up potentially showing up in the 797.
Yeah, and there's certainly something. Are they going to spend the engineering resources to come up with a new wing as well?
Hmm.
Right, and that's certainly a major component when it comes to costs in designing the aircraft, but you get the benefit on the back end with the efficiency.
Right, right. So, it's always fun to watch what happens. There's a lot of things that have to fall into place for this to go forward. Of course, there has to be a belief that there's a sufficient demand to warrant those development costs and so forth. But absolutely, we'll be watching this. It's always fun when something new comes along. We get another run of 6, 8, 10 years worth of talking, I guess.
yeah, I'm just sad that it's going to take so long to actually come to market.
Yeah. But
like you said, the conversation in between time. Here's our tanker. Here's our F-35. Here's our insert the fun plane topic here.
Right. Well, speaking of new aircraft, we have an item from General Aviation News. Companies form alliance for hybrid aircraft. Now, this is XTI Aircraft Company teaming up with Bai Aerospace to develop a hybrid electric-powered prototype of their TriFan. That's a vertical takeoff airplane. Max T, this is sort of a, this is not an airliner-sized airplane.
No, six passengers, but it's really remarkable. The team, of course, is XTI with Bai Aerospace. George Bai is the person behind that. And interestingly, both of those companies had a common person on the board, Charlie Johnson, who used to be, I believe, chief operating officer of Cessna. Both the Colorado companies, which makes it work well for them. And they've just announced that they're going to build the first prototype, and they're going to, instead of building a 65% scale version, they're going to build the entire thing. But it does say that they're replacing the original plan for twin turboshaft engines with electric motors, and there are three ducted fans on this, two of which will rotate from horizontal to vertical, and one of which is only vertical for takeoff. And then it's got a sliding door, which covers that one up afterwards for forward flight. If you go to the website for them, it's xtiaircraft.com. They give even more details. They say range of 1,500 plus nautical miles, 2,600 shaft horsepower, which is pretty phenomenal amount of power. Time to altitude, which they, in two different places, one says 29,000 feet and the other says 35,000 feet, 11 minutes. It's just, here's the kicker, 340 knots. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, that's pretty zippy.
I kind of wonder how much fuel is this thing going to burn, or how big are those batteries going to be?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, we see more electric or hybrid electric designs, people working on that kind of a concept. Sometimes you see a design where you might have a conventional kind of an engine, a fossil fuel burning engine that generates electricity for the electric motors. And other times you have solar cells, and other times you have battery power. A lot of different approaches being tried. It'll be interesting to see which of these become really commercially viable.
At least by the photographs, it's a gorgeous looking aircraft. And Max T, I'm not sure if you remember, but we had George Bai on as a guest on episode 323.
I remember very well. I had run into George at a convention before that, which is how we found him. I was going to mention one thing about the design. You're right, it's really elegant. And one thing that's really going to help from an engineering standpoint, the problem with a lot of kind of tilt rotor designs is that when they are operating vertically, a lot of the thrust is lost because of the interference with the wing, which is below those rotors. What they've done with this design is the entire fan rotates so that there's no interference vertically. It's just kind of mounted in a forward section of the wing so that the wings will not interfere with the downward thrust. So rather clever.
Yeah. Do either of you know, is there a section of the wing that produces more lift than the other part? Because the fans on this one are really close to the fuselage. And I'm just wondering, is that the part of the wing that produces the least amount of lift? Therefore, it makes sense to put the fans there?
Interesting question. That sounds like something we should know the answer to, but I don't. Yep.
No, you've stumped us here.
All right. Someone smarter than the three of us write to us and help us out with that. Yeah. Does the lift vary across the length or, the chord of a wing?
And I want to tell our listeners, at least we don't make stuff up. If we don't know the answer, we'll admit it.
We admit it.
So in this case, we don't know.
Or, hey, if we want to sound really smart, let's just cut that part. No one will ever know.
The power of editing. That's funny.
Yeah, that's never happened, of course. Let's move on to AIN Online. This is an article by Amy Labota. Amy actually was also a guest, but way back in episode 89, if you can believe it. Amy, of course, you hear her on UCAP, Uncontrolled Airspace. That's where I first ran across Amy. But she writes, Women in Aviation 2017, We're Hiring. Now, The International Women in Aviation Conference for 2017 was held March 2nd through 4th in Florida. And a lot of aviation companies came and really kind of demonstrated some interest in, well, in hiring, looking for candidates or just building a network with students, perhaps, that could ultimately become candidates for hiring. But Gulfstream Aerospace, for example, they brought some pilots. There's a quote, "We are here because this magnitude of conference attracts top-notch aviation talent, and we are hiring that talent." There were other large companies. Walmart actually came with some representatives from their corporate flight department. They had a booth in the exhibit hall. Others were there as well. But the picture that Amy Labota paints in this article is that, you know, there really is a lot of opportunity, and sounds like these companies are foreseeing the need for hiring some folks.
Yeah, I've been to this conference before, and it is probably the most kind of career-focused hiring conference I have ever seen in the aviation industry. So people have really kind of figured out that if you want to learn how to go into sessions where they will teach you how to prepare for the interview, as well as you know, meet with companies that have booths who are hiring, it is absolutely the place to go. So yeah, the Women in Aviation Conference, you just can't beat it if you're a pilot looking to figure out how to get hired in the industry.
And when you talk about getting hired in the industry, there's, you know, there's working in the industry and there's sort of working in the profession. And an example of that is Amazon.com, all right? They're not, as a core business, they're not an aviation company, but we know they're starting to operate Prime Air, and they've got some, 40 aircraft flying for that. The quote from Amazon was that, "We are filling out our flight department, hiring business analysts, carrier program managers, principal products managers, airframe program and engine managers, quality assurance." It just goes on and on. So as we've said before, you can look for an aviation job in places other than what you might normally think of as, you know, strictly an aviation company.
We should mention to people, just because it's called Women in Aviation doesn't mean only women go to that conference.
That's right.
I mean, the really savvy guys are there as well. Now, I would say that, you know, more than half the people there are indeed women, but there's a substantial number of guys there. So just because it's called Women in Aviation, don't think that you know, men are not allowed at the conference. They do participate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I've been as well, and it's been a fascinating experience, but. Many others were there. Pratt & Whitney was there. Mary Ann Cannon, she's the VP for commercial programs. I knew Mary Ann Cannon when I was at Pratt. They're looking for logistics and safety professionals, mechanics and engineers. Textron was there representing Bell Helicopter and True Flight Simulations. They said that they're welcoming 300 interns this summer into the company in sales, engineering, and flight operations. Talking to some of them here at the show, it's a great opportunity for us to get in touch with the aviation community as a whole because of the diversity here. And others were there. Patty Wagstaff was there, I guess, and astronaut Dr. Yvonne Cagle was there speaking about educating youth. So great event, and I absolutely second what Max T. said, that if you're a woman, you definitely want to, in aviation, I think you definitely want to look at this organization, and if you're not, you probably want to look at this organization anyway. There's a lot of value there.
Yep. And the other thing that's worth noting about this organization, they probably give away more money in scholarships than any other aviation organization around. So anybody who's looking for some money or some ratings, you know, check out the Women in Aviation website and find out, you know, when the application, you know, time window is going to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. And although I've never been to the conference, I think that it's fantastic that they emphasize not only the pilot positions, but all of the other things that are available within aviation. So it's not just flying an aircraft. Right. And to me, that's really great.
Okay. Moving on. Cranky Flyer. We have an article here. If you thought the Alaska Virgin America merger was anti-competitive, take a look at San Francisco. So since its merger with Alaska, I guess Virgin America has added a number of new destinations from San Francisco, and it kind of looks like a strategy shift, I guess, with Virgin America now adding mid-sized markets. That was something that Alaska was successful at doing. Instead of what they normally did, was go for the large market approach that was kind of characteristic of Virgin America. So, Max T., what do you think about what's developing here?
Oh, I think those of us on the West Coast are pretty excited about it. Virgin has always been one of my favorite go-to airlines, JetBlue being the other one. They have awesome service, nice aircraft, and it's just great to see them going into more cities. Of course, their hub is in San Francisco, which is a great destination in and of itself. What intrigued me as I was reading the article was just how they were kind of mixing and matching aircraft between the two fleets, Alaska and Virgin, to greater advantage. So, for example, whereas Virgin, the smallest planes they've had in the past are the A. 319s, I believe. They are now going to start using some Alaska Embraer 175 so they can start serving some smaller cities. And that really helps them. Their fleet's pretty small. I visited their headquarters probably about 2 years ago, and I think they had around 55, top 60 aircraft, all kind of A320, 321 class. They've got about half a dozen new aircraft being delivered. And I know that they were excited simply because there was going to be a lot of hiring. I forget how many new crews are added for each new aircraft, but it's at least five. Maybe it's as many as 10. They require a lot of staffing to keep each of these aircraft in the air.
No, Max T, I think you really like it in San Francisco because you're getting all these additional destinations where it feels as though many of them are getting pulled from Los Angeles. So good for you guys up north.
Yeah, I hadn't realized that.
Yeah.
Yeah, this really strikes me as a merger where they really thought about why they wanted to merge in the first place and what the strategy post-merger was going to be. Because, as you say, they're making such good effective use of the assets across the two companies that it's stronger and more powerful than either of them separate. And that's the whole idea of a merger. Or I guess oftentimes that's what should be the whole idea.
And at San Francisco, they're even moving terminals around so that they can get their gates closer together. Right now, one of them is in the international terminal. Another one is in another terminal. I forget which is which. I think Virgin's the international terminal. So they're working to get them much closer together so that people don't have to take a long bus ride from one terminal to the other when they change planes in San Francisco.
Yeah, or a very long stroll and have to go through security again. That's never fun.
No.
All right, one last news item. This is kind of a combination of kind of humorous, but also kind of serious at the same time. This was in flyer.co.uk, fake flying instructor convicted. So, Max T., what's going on here?
I always look to see what international stories are of interest, and this one, frankly, would have caught me no matter where it happened. Very, very unusual. People talk about malpractice, people who try to pretend to be lawyers, try to pretend to be doctors. Boy, I haven't run into too many people who pretend to be flight instructors, and I find that rather scary. Yeah. I just can't imagine, someone out there in the public paying their money and thinking they're getting a lesson from somebody who knows what they're doing. This article doesn't go into a whole lot of detail as to exactly what he did with his fake license. He was the operations manager for an airport for the, and I'm going to say this wrong, of course, the North Weald Airfield. That's Weald, which I guess is somewhere in England.
Essex.
And the Cambridge Crown Court was told that this gentleman learned to fly gliders, but he did not have a license to fly powered aircraft. Oops. So anyway, that's a big oops. Anyway, he was given an 8-month jail sentence, suspended for 14 months, ordered to carry out 140 hours of unpaid work, and has to pay £750 in cost. Boy, I can think of a better punishment for him, but we're not allowed to throw people out of airplanes. So
this guy is a 25-year-old, and of course, I was interested as I was looking at this to say, well, okay, how did they catch this guy? And I guess some of his coworkers got a little bit suspicious, and it doesn't say why. Maybe they didn't see the skill level they expected. I don't know. But they got a little suspicious, so they sort of investigated his background and found that he had falsified some documents and had made this up. And so that led to him being outed, as it were. I guess he could have gotten a tougher sentence, but he pled guilty, and I guess the judge was impressed by the fact that he sort of owned up to his misdeed.
I guess judges aren't used to seeing that.
Yeah.
Yeah, Max T, so what can a student do to ensure that their instructor is properly credentialed?
Oh, there's a really easy way to do kind of a first pass screen, which is go to the FAA's Airman Database, put in their name, and see exactly what certificates they have. Now, they're not going to tell you how much experience they have or whether they're any good, but they'll at least tell you, you know, whether or not they've got a current license. And for the flight instructor rating, that goes away every 2 years. So if you don't renew it, it's not going to show up. So that one actually does have a, you know, certain amount of currency that you can determine by looking at the website for that. Now, they said that he was guilty of 3 counts of acting as flight crew without holding an appropriate license and 2 counts of forgery of documents with attempting to deceive. They said he also was taking friends flying in the aircraft, and he'd also signed off pilot's licenses, which I guess means he had recommended people for check rides or had given them BFRs or done something that an instructor would be able to do. So, pretty amazing. Yeah. Cheeky young man, isn't he?
Well, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Did he really think he could get away with this? I mean, what was his objective here? I don't know. But
I think he probably was watching the movies and he saw Catch Me If You Can.
And they did.
That's right. If he could get away with being a Pan Am pilot, why couldn't this guy get away with being a flight instructor?
All right, let's move on to Heli Expo 2017. That was recently held in Texas, and Launchpad Marzari, who you've heard on and off different points, different episodes with some recorded reports, offered to act as our reporter on the floor there at Heli Expo, and he did. And he sent us a number of relatively short interviews, which we'll present to you right now. The first one comes from the CBP, Customs and Border Protection. And he talked to Matt Noble. And let's listen to Launchpad.
This is Launchpad Marzari. And we're here at HAI. And we're at the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Air and Marine Operations. And I'm with
Air Interdiction Agent Matt Noble.
And he's with the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. And why is Customs and Borders at the helicopter show?
Well, we're with Air Marine Operations. We are one of the largest aviation law enforcement agencies in the United States. And we're simply here because we're hiring pilots. We're looking for commercial rated and instrument rated helicopter pilots, airplane pilots, or if you have both, that's even better. And we are intending to hire a lot of pilots over the next several years. One of the main reasons is we have a lot of guys starting to retire and they're collecting their pensions and they're moving on from Air Marine. So we're looking for guys of all experiences and all ages to come and apply with us. And so we can get them into a 20-year career. We can get them a lot of experience flying law enforcement missions, mostly on the southwest border and in Puerto Rico. And you're going to fly aircrafts from helicopters to airplanes to UASs. And we got all kinds of opportunities. We have about 7 different locations we're hiring for right now. And we're trying to just get out there and get into the aviation community just to let everybody know that we are hiring pilots and that we are looking for them, especially if they are looking for a new career. And we're not looking for guys that are overnight jobs. We're looking for somebody that wants a 20-year solid career that they can have a pension from, that they can have a retirement from.
What's minimum hours you're looking for? Because that's a question that many of our listeners keep asking.
Yeah, our minimum hours, we just went away several months ago from our dual rated requirement. So now all you need is a commercial license with an instrument ticket, 1,500 hours, 75 hours night or NVG, 75 hours hood or instrument, combination of both. And you can use simulator time for that, 100 hours in the last 12 months and 250 hours pilot and command time.
Okay. But you still hold to the, like, or commercial airlines to the 1,500 hours.
Right now, we are still holding to the 1,500 hours. I will say we're kind of announcing it here that in the coming, in the near future, we are going to be going to an experience-based flight hour waiver. We're looking at going to down to 1,000 hours total time, and where we'll waive that extra, that 500 hours between the 1,500 hours will be on experience. We haven't officially put it out yet, but it is coming.
Okay, and if our listeners are interested, where would they apply?
To find our job, just simply go on to usajobs.gov and type in keywords 1881. That's 1881, and that's an air interdiction agent. And from there, they can follow the steps on USA Jobs. They got to make sure that they have a copy of their pilot license. They need to have a copy of their medical. You can have a Class 2 medical to apply. You'll need a Class 1 at the time of application. And then there's several other documents they may need. And veterans, we can actually have a special opportunity for veterans where we can hire veterans directly to our agency by simply reaching out to one of our recruiters, and they can hire directly to us. And that allows us to go kind of around the USA Jobs process, and it streamlines the process a little more. They do that by giving us a copy of their federal resume. They give us a copy of their FAA certificate, medical, Class 2 or higher. Their DD-214, and if the veteran's still active duty, all we need is a service letter of from their command, and just the last 100 hours of their logbook. And in the logbook pages, we just need to see the 75-hour instrument, the 75-hour night or higher, and their total time, and along with the 250 hours pilot and command time.
Okay, thank you. And for the geeks in us, what aircraft are you guys flying?
We fly all kinds of aircraft. It's hard to narrow it down to one, but we fly anything from the A-Star, Blackhawk, EC-120 on up to the King Air 350, Dash 8, P-3s, and then Predator Bs for our UASs, just to name a few.
Well, thank you, Matt. And where do they go if they want job-specific information?
The best way to get job-specific information is to visit our website at cbp.gov/careers/frontline careers and look for air interdiction agent.
Got it. Sounds like a fun life. All right. This is Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved.
Oh, that's pretty interesting, huh?
Lots of jobs out there.
Yeah. I'm looking at the job posting, the air interdiction agent posting that's up there right now as we record this. The open period is the entire month of March, but I see that this is at multiple locations, 7 locations, so some choices there. Yeah, very interesting, very interesting. Next, we have Launchpad talking with Charles Schneider. He's the CEO of MyGoFlight. They do iPad flight apps and accessories. Listen to this. It's pretty interesting, especially when he starts talking about a heads-up display.
This is Launchpad Marzari, and I'm here with Charles Schneider, CEO of MyGoFlight. And you've got a pretty interesting backstory, sir. Tell us how you first got into aviation.
So about 10 years ago, I have another business that's called Builder Sourcing. We work with home builders around the country. One of our clients said, hey, you know what, you ought to consider flying. It'd be easier for you to get around the country and to get closer to your customers. Having thought that it was never even anything to even be considered that I could do or afford, I had never considered it. And he took me flying in his aircraft. We liked it, thought the idea was really good. Struggled with trying to organize, you know, getting an instructor and a plane available at the same time. So he said, okay, forget that method. We're going to buy the aircraft and then learn how to fly, and that's what we did.
And what airplane did you buy out of the box?
So we bought a Cirrus SR-22 G3 Turbo, which was the fastest airplane we could buy and still be able to learn on it.
Nice. Good choice, sir. And tell us how that led you to where you are today.
So along the way in instruction, I was handed this massive pile of charts. And I said, what is that for? And they said, well, you're going to figure out where you are in the aircraft and connect this page to that or look up a chart or look up information. I said, oh, really? At 200 knots, I'm going to be opening up a AAA map? I don't think so. And went and bought a $5,000 laptop computer and loaded up Jetstar and Flight Deck and went digital from the start. But the idea that that was a laptop was a misnomer, because in an aircraft, nothing stays where it's supposed to be. It would leave our lap and reconfigure the aircraft at 200 knots. So when the iPad came out, I thought, well, that's a device we could secure. We bought one, made some products for that to secure it in our aircraft. Other pilots saw it, and then, you know, 6 years later, we have a big business centered around making the iPad really usable in aircraft, whether you're securing it, mounting it, using it as an e-board, trying to look at it, getting rid of the glare, powering it, all of that we have built product for over the last 6 years.
So basically, you started out building the product for you personally and then decided to market it to the rest of us.
They decided that for me. They wanted those products, so we made them for them, and then we continued to innovate along the way, and now we have quite the catalog.
Here at Heli Expo, what have you got that's new in MyGoFlight?
So we've now, this is our third year at Heli Expo, and having listened to helicopter pilots about what their needs are, we've come up with several very specific hard mount solutions for helicopters, some things for the Robinson, some things for the Bell, Airbus, and the like, that allow the iPad to be secured in the aircraft and made usable. We've also innovated and created a sunshade for those that find that there's too much light and they're losing the ability to see the screen, so we've come out with a product for that. We also are demonstrating our concept product, which is a head-up display unit that takes chips data and can display that right in front of the pilot looking out in front, as well as a connection to night vision camera so that it can show, if you're coming in on a landing spot, what it is you're looking at before you get there, as if turning day nighttime into day. So it's a pretty cool product.
Wow, a HUD for us normal GA pilots. And it's pulling its data from where, sir?
So the flight deck has its instrumentation, the digital instrumentation, that can have something called ARINC 429 and RS-232 data outputs. We can tap into that data and then repeat that up into the head-up display unit.
Okay, I'm looking at the HUD now. Tell me what I'm looking at as far as what information it's given me.
So we have things like wings level position, pitch and roll, altitude, pressure altitude, and indicated airspeed, ground speed, AGL, information like that.
Wow, that's pretty slick for a for us general aviation pilots. When will you be ready to bring this to market, are you?
We are currently working with a few large fleet operators on installing it in their aircraft type and working through the certification process. And so I hope that that goes as fast as it can, and as soon as that's done, we will be out in the market in a general use product.
So this will be an STC product?
It will be a FAA-approved product, yes. The rules are changing for Part 23 and Part 27. We are working with the Small Airplane Directorate to define the specifications, but yes, at the end of the day, it'll be an FAA-approved product. With mounting systems that would be STC'd for the various aircraft that are looking to have these units put into them.
Well, that's exciting. Mr. Schneider, I'd like to take the time to thank you for educating our Airplane Geeks audience and say thank you very much. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
So, Max T, what do you think about a HUD display?
Well, it sounds, sounds like fun to me. I think anything that makes it easier to get information in front of pilots is helpful. I'd be interesting to see just how much does it obscure things outside the window. I think that perhaps the only downside of that might be if people's focus, their eyes were focused 3 or 4 feet in front of them to look at the HUD display instead of focused at infinity looking for traffic. Then they might be less likely to spot traffic. But that's the only downside I can see.
I want one of those for my car. All right. Next up, Launchpad talked with Emmanuel Davidson. He's the president of AOPA France. They talk about medical. Now, Launchpad noted, and you'll hear they talk of first med, and they misspoke. They really meant basic med. So when you hear them say first med, just think basic med, and you'll be on track. So here they are.
This is Launchpad Marzari with another pilot report from Heli Expo. And I'm here with Emmanuel Davidson, who is the AOPA France president. Sir.
Hello to you, Launchpad. Glad to be with you guys.
What I wanted to ask you is, lately AOPA has had a very strong victory with getting First Med pushed through. Are you going to be able to try and leverage that in with AOPA France?
Well, we all agree that MedFirst is a great victory because flying should be easy, and with the progress that medicine has done in the recent years, it was only normal that our medical certification would evolve also. To answer your question shortly, yes, we're going to try to leverage on that victory in the U.S., all around Europe. Currently, for the LSA category that we consider nearly like ultralights, there is no real medical certification in most of the countries in Europe. And as we go forward, and that the legislation around light planes is evolving also, we don't see why the medical certification should not change in Europe. So, yes, we're going to work a lot on this.
I understand IOPA, and explain to me and to our listening audience how your relationship, AOPA France, with IAOPA.
Well, IAOPA is simply the abbreviation of the International Council of AOPAs. As you know, there are over 78 AOPAs in the world now that are representing the interests of pilots and are fighting to defend their freedom. Freedom to access airspace, to access the airfields, but also we fight a lot to make sure that the regulations that we have to live with are going to be as light as possible, proportionate when you consider the rules regarding airlines. We don't want to be treated like airliners because we are not. And for this, of course, in the U.S., AOPA is an enormous organization, and we have lighter organizations all over the world that group by region. So if I take the example of the European region, we are probably about 20 members of different European countries, and we all work together, meet on a very, very regular basis to align all the AOPAs on the same positions. Then the representative of each national AOPA go back to their national aviation authorities and petition them to change regulations or to modify regulations. When we have them on our side, then we go back to EASA and we say, well, our national aviation authorities, AOPAs, and most of the pilots, frankly, agree on this position. Isn't it time that we start to change things? And in the recent years, since the new Director General of EASA has been named, Mr. Patrick Key, we found a very, very strong ally in EASA, and we see changes that we didn't think would be possible just a few months ago suddenly become possible.
Wow. We're really moving out, I see, with, you know, your IAOPA and with the French AOPA. So what do you think here of Heli Expo?
Well, it's the first time, actually, I come to Heli Expo because I was more of on the fixed wing side, so I hope that nobody will slap me on the head for that here. But I was really impressed to see how vibrant that sector is. If I have to defend the French territory a little bit, I would say that seeing the helicopters gamble with the G2 here having so much success was really heartening. And but when you see, when you look at the audience, when you look at all the vendors that are here, there is a lot of business going on, but what really touched me also, there is a lot of passion going on. And that's what I really like to see in aviation.
Sir, thank you for taking your time and giving us a moment. Welcome to the United States. Look forward to seeing you again at some of the other aviation events. This is Launchpad Marzari, frequency change approved. Good day.
I think that's an example of the power of an international organization. You know, we make progress here in one area in the United States, and you know that can translate around the world. And similarly, when you know they make progress in certain areas, the rest of the world can benefit from that. I think that's really powerful.
Yeah, it's all pushing each other forward.
All right, next up, Launchpad talked with Bill Thompson from Embry-Riddle And he asked why Embry-Riddle was there at Heli Expo. Interesting response.
Launchpad Marzari with another spot report here at HAI. And I'm with Bill Thompson from Embry-Riddle. So tell me, sir, why is Embry-Riddle here at HAI?
Well, the reason Embry-Riddle's here at HAI is because our alumni, 125,000 plus of them, are around the world, and so many of them work in the helicopter industry. They are in the aviation side, the MRO side, the sales side, the manufacturing side, the design side, and the piloting side. We're all over the place here, and we have an event in our booth where we invite them here. We'll have about 100 of our alumni here tonight. But most importantly, it's about connecting with our alumni in this industry, which is really part of what Embry-Riddle is all about, aviation and aerospace.
Very cool. And so you're not so much here recruiting as just supporting your graduates.
So true. Recruiting is always a subtle part of what we do. But when you take a look at what Embry-Riddle does, our graduates are out there. Many of them do want to have advanced degrees or some certification courses. Those are the ones that can come to talk to us. But in this particular age demographic of who's at HAI, they're not high school students until Thursday, I think, when they tour the facility. Generally, what we're dealing with are individuals who want some advanced learning, maybe their master's degree, maybe go for their PhD. But most importantly, they're reconnecting with us in many ways that we can help and support them, oftentimes with job searching as well.
And if they want to learn more, where would they go?
If they want to learn more, they can come back to Embry-Riddle at www.erau.edu. And most importantly, either look at our worldwide campuses, 125 locations around the world, or our Daytona Beach, Florida campus, or Prescott, Arizona, where we actually have our helicopter flight training program.
Well, thank you, Mr. Thompson. And this is Launchpad Marzari for the Airplane Geeks podcast, Frequency Change Approved.
It's so often about networking. I mean, Max, we were talking about Women in Aviation International. A lot of the value of events like that and like this one here is just the networking opportunities.
Oh, yeah. That's probably the main reason I've enjoyed going to places like Oshkosh. I remember years ago being in the tent for the National Association of Flight Instructors, and I was in the back of the tent talking with people. Everybody else was standing out at the front watching the air show. They kind of commented and said, "Hey, there's an air show going over here." And I thought, "Yeah, but that's the boring part compared to talking with people."
All right, another recording, another interview from Launchpad Marzari. This is with John Beatty. He's with the Cold War Air Museum. Now, that's in Texas. It's about 20 miles south of Dallas, Texas. And they have some very, very interesting aircraft, and they had one at the show. So here they are.
This is Launchpad Marzari, and we're coming again from Heli Expo, and we've stumbled across something you normally don't see at Heli Expo. I'm standing in front of an Mi-28, and I'm here with
John Beatty, Cold War Air Museum.
And this is your aircraft, right?
This is the museum's aircraft. In fact, we have two Mi-24s.
Well, this is one. It's really pretty. Tell me about the paint on it.
So over the last 2 years, one of the last things we wound up doing in the restoration process was repainting it and re-stenciling it. So we actually built a paint booth in the hangar and with a positive ventilation and all the other stuff that the airport wants us to have, and went out and found the right paint and found the book of how to make all the stencils and put it back together just the way it looks on the airfield in Russia.
Yeah, I was going to say, and all the stencils are in Cyrillic and in Russian. How did you make that happen?
So that's kind of an interesting process. I went ahead and I took pictures of the original stencils. Then I hired a guy off of Elance to make me a Cyrillic stencil font for Windows that exactly matched the original stencils. And he came back and did a perfect job. And then we went in and we went through the book and started typing stuff in. Contacted our Russian friends and said, would you spell check this for us? And then we cut the stencils, put them on the aircraft, and painted the stencils that you see on it. There's 216 stencils on this.
And how would you know that?
Yeah, I would, because I made all of those stuff.
Yeah, because you normally don't think about, what font of Cyrillic you need.
Right. So this is... This looks as close to the original as the guys, our mechanics, are familiar with the original Russian stuff, and they said, this looks perfect, right? And they were real happy with it, and they did a really good job, and the paint's holding up really well, and it's beautiful, and really, it looks good.
Oh, it looks fantastic. How many flight hours a year do you do on it?
Our pilots probably get, in between training and practice and some of the places that they go, maybe 40 hours per helicopter per year. It flies pretty regularly, and when it flies, it doesn't usually go very far because we kind of stick to air shows in Texas, or we'll run down to Fort Hood to play basically show and tell.
Aggressors.
We don't play a show. Aggressors. Like the Dutch guys will come in. They'll be visiting Fort Hood, and we'll bring the helicopter down, and so they can just crawl all over it, and then we bring it back, and then we get paid for that. So, you know, happy to do it. Right.
Speaking of flying it around, what instruments did you have to change from the Russian instruments to be FAA instrument or FAA certified instruments?
So the only thing the FAA really expects you to do is to have an altimeter in feet. The airspeed indicator can still be in clicks. The VSI can still be in meters per second.
As opposed to being in feet per minute.
Right.
Do the math in your head.
Actually, the math on that's not too bad. You can just double it. Right? 2 meters per second is 1,000 feet a minute.
Well, that makes it semi-easy. Did you replace the altimeter, or did you just put an auxiliary one in?
We replaced the altimeter. So the funny thing is, all of this stuff, because of Lend-Lease out of World War II, the instrument sizes are all the same. The hole locations are all of the same. Even the screws that go in them, even though they're listed as a metric size, are the same. So you could put a Cessna altimeter in this, and it goes right in.
That's funny. That's how convenient standardization without intent.
Yep.
Talk to me about that. Did you have to change out the radios?
No, so we didn't. We originally thought we were going to change out the radios, and then we noticed that the Russian radios and the Russian intercom and the Russian everything had been designed all to work with each other, and it worked really, really good. So the original radios in this, you had to program, you pulled the head out, it had 20 channels, you kind of fished at it with a knitting needle, and you set the stuff on there. What we did do is we kind of got an interception in the cannon plug that came out of there. We had a little Arduino project and an XCOM head. So we've got the original equipment still in there, but the XCOM head now sets basically the pin positions on the programming. And the intercom is set up so that you know, there's no squeal because all that's been worked out. And the radios, I don't know how many watts radios are, but I'll put it this way. If you park your car next to the aircraft and light up the radios, it'll light up the headlights on the car. It's a real good radio.
Don't worry, nobody from the FAA is listening. Do the Russians have a VOR system?
So their VOR system is real similar to our VOR system. In fact, if you program the channels on this, the navigation equipment in this will lights right up and works.
Okay. And was this purchase new enough to have the Soviets' GPS system in it?
So it had an inertial navigation system and a moving map. And by a moving map, I mean the map literally moves in this aircraft. There's a couple little crosshairs that actually move across the map. That system works okay. What we mostly do is it's a nice big blank space on the panel to put an iPad with ForeFlight or something like that on it, right? Because that's just so much easier to do.
Yes, there's being authentic, then there's being, look, I just need to fly it somewhere. It's a gorgeous aircraft, and if people want to see you out on tour, what's your schedule?
So the schedule's posted on our website, and mostly we just go to air shows in Texas because it gets 2 miles to the gallon, and there's not a lot of people that want to pay for it to come out of state. But we're going to be down at, I believe we're going to be at Waco, we're going to be at Corsicana, we're going to be at Alliance, where we wish the people at Ellington, if you're listening, would come invite us and pay for our gas to go. He's never been to Houston. But anyway, our schedule is posted. It's www.cwam, as in Cold War Air Museum.org, because we're a museum.
Another question. Are you burning just regular Jet A?
Burns regular Jet A, but it burns a lot of it, right? In a hover, it burns about 225 gallons an hour. When you get going, it actually goes, it's a pretty fast helicopter, the second fastest helicopter in the world. It'll cruise 180 if you want it. Typically, we cruise about 160, but you're burning about 180 gallons an hour at that. But it never does get a mile per gallon out of it.
I was going to say, what's economic cruise for it?
Yeah, there is no economic cruise for it.
All right. Well, thank you. And again, state your company and your website.
So Cold War Air Museum, www.cwam.org.
This is Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Well, I probably should have mentioned before the interview that this is a helicopter gunship. And I'm not sure where one goes to purchase or procure a helicopter gunship, especially a Soviet one. But I guess these have been around for a long time, and they're used in quite a large number of countries. So maybe there's a market for these, I guess. But it's really a spectacular-looking gunship.
Well, and it sounds like you need deep pockets in order to pay for the fuel.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yes.
And this is the helicopter that you sometimes see in movies, you know, for the Russian aggressor helicopter. It looks like it has a pair of arms sticking out from it with three hard points on each side of the gunship. And I got to tell you, it just gives me the willies. Every time I've seen this helicopter in a movie, it's like, ugh, you just kind of want to curl up and hide. I think if I saw one of these things out in the wild, I would just kind of, you know, say, okay, my days are over.
Yeah, it's menacing.
Yeah, it really looks like it could take out just about anything.
Yes, yeah. All right, next up, Launchpad Marzari talks with Giovanni Mazzoni about the AW609. He's the program manager for that helicopter. So here they are.
This is Launchpad Marzari coming at you again from Heli Expo. And today I'm with my long-lost cousin, Giovanni Mazzoni from Leonardo Helicopters, and he is the program manager for the AW609.
Nice to meet you, and I'm very proud to be part of these channels.
And for those of you who don't know, the 609 is a civilian tilt rotor. Actually, I'm going to let you describe the 609 to our listeners.
The 609 is the civilian tilt rotor, and will be the first civilian tilt rotor certified. So that is very, very important. If for who is familiar, you can think about the V-22 that represents what today we have in the military market, that is linked with the SAFE, starting from the SAFE technology concept, but now is moving to the civil market, so implies to have an increased level of safety, some design changes that will, and above all, to have a complete process of certification with FAA that will permit us to sell and to enter into the market in the next few years.
Okay, and Leonardo Helicopter now owns complete ownership of the aircraft and the development process. Is that correct?
Yes, starting from 2011, we acquired 100% of the project from Bell Helicopter, and now we are completely owning, and we have the full leadership of the project. And for that reason, we are putting on the table all the maximum effort to reach the certification within 2018.
And you had a couple of big milestones that have started with aircrafts 3 and 4 already.
Yes, this year is for sure an important year because we have already started certification test activities. And this year we are planning to do his trials in Michigan starting this month, in the next days. And with the Aircraft 3. The Aircraft 3 is an aircraft that is flying in Philadelphia. And in addition to that, we have also the assembly of the Aircraft 4 that is assembled in Philadelphia and will fly this year and will join the fleet. Today we have planning to arrive to the certification with three different prototypes. Two are the Aircraft 3 and Aircraft 4. The other one is the Aircraft 1 that today is in Europe and will be used to conduct a load level survey.
This is very exciting, and one of the things I want to bring up to get really into our name, the airplane geeks, to do a geeky question, explain to us how you yaw the aircraft in a hover without having a tail rotor.
Yes, it's important to understand that this aircraft and above all the rotor system has been designed following all the technology and the logic that are behind an helicopter. So there are swoosh plate, fixed swoosh plate, rotating swoosh plate, there are drive links. And for that reason, if you need, and in addition to that, this aircraft is fully fly-by-wire. So you have an extensive interaction among the computers that is supporting the pilot. For what concerns your question, so to act in you, we are using a differential thrust of the rotors because you can work differentially with the rotor itself and generate a momentum that creates the yacht, as I said, along around the center of gravity of the aircraft itself. So you have to imagine that for the pilot, it's completely transparent. The pilot will have the same controls that are present on an helicopter, but the computer will act on the surfaces in a different way if you are in helicopter mode or in an airplane mode.
And that brings me to my second geek question, is at what point do the flight controls transfer from being in the helicopter mode to the flight mode? Is that based on how far down the nacelles are tilted or a forward airspeed?
The aircraft itself is designed to take off with a nacelle around 90 degrees if you are taking off like an helicopter. But then you can imagine that you can also take off in a short takeoff mode. If you are tilting the nacelle, for example, 75 degrees, you will start to have not only a thrust in the direction of on the forward direction, but you are starting to have also a lift. And so the tilting of the nacelle is decided by the pilot. It's supported by the computer if needed, because there is a specific corridors where you can do the tilting that is obviously related with several parameters. But the goal of this, the aim or the peculiarity of this aircraft is to do the transition as fast as possible, because when you are in the airplane mode, you are in a condition where you are flying very in an efficient way. You can reduce also the RPM, because you are reducing to 84 the power for the engine, so you are also reducing the fuel consumption, and you can in that way reach the range that are typical of this aircraft, and they can make this aircraft together with the speed something different from an helicopter and from a fixed wing.
This is fascinating stuff. We're excited to see this come to market. I'd like to thank you, sir, for taking the time. We've been talking to Giovanni Massoni. This is Launchpad Marzari from the Airplane Geeks podcast. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Yeah, it looks similar to the V-22 Osprey, but maybe with a svelter fuselage. It's kind of nice looking. And with aircraft number 4 coming together in Philadelphia, maybe David have an opportunity to take a look at this. That'd be kind of exciting.
Yep, that's certainly the home of Boeing Vertol, where the V-22 development was done. It's just amazing to me how many years that took. When I was in college in the Philly area, it was you know, they started develop then, and it was back in the 70s.
Wow. Hard to believe. Yeah, yeah. Well, we have one more interview from Launchpad Marzari. Now, he ran into a journalist at Heli Expo. He calls this sort of a self-licking ice cream cone type of interview. So,
let's listen.
This is Launchpad Marzari with another spot report here from Heli Expo. And boy, the CEOs and important people are out. There's Giovanni, the head of Leonardo Helicopter. There's the head of Sikorsky Helicopter. Look, there's noted journalists from Flying Magazine. Mr. Mark. Can I ask you a couple of questions?
What?
Yeah, hi, I'm from the Airplane Geeks podcast.
Okay, sure. I mean, are you an airplane or are you the geek? I mean,
I'm kind of the geek. We're a podcast. Uh-huh. Are you familiar with podcasts?
Yeah, sure. That's, I don't know. Don't they do something like that with that UAV junk? You know,
but we do it for real airplanes.
Oh, okay. So I'm really kind of stressed out here. So what is it that you need from me? Because I have really important things to do, if I can remember them. I'm sure there were a lot of them. Actually, I don't think I have anything to do. So what do you want to do? Why am I here?
Well, I assume you're here to do the same thing we are, is to cover Heli Expo.
I thought I came for lunch. That's all I came for, was lunch. Actually, you know, the good thing about being here, catching up with you, is that Max and David and Brian and Max will all know I was really here, and that I wasn't just making up the fact that I couldn't be on the show on Monday.
I think that's the whole reason you texted me and said, meet me here in the hotel lobby.
We aren't going to talk about that, remember? No, this is actually kind of neat. We're over by what are we at? Is this Leonardo?
We are in Leonardo, and they are doing a VR virtual rescue.
I think it would be fun if if you get to do that, we could take a little video of you going up into the stratosphere. But what if you don't come back?
I still get rider credit.
Okay. All right. So, guys, in case Launchpad doesn't make it back after his test, he's going to get full credit for his sacrifice. Hey, listen, guys, actually, it's been pretty fun here at Heli Expo, and I'm sorry I don't have more to say, but I have about four stories I need to go write here in a little bit.
Oh, that's for that other minor publication.
Yeah, well, you know, the ones that pay the salary now these days. But Launchpad seems to have things in good hands here, and I'm going to turn it over to him, so we'll talk to you guys soon. Bye!
And this is Launchpad Marzari. Frequency change approved. Good day.
Well, that's really cool. So they have celebrities at this show as well.
Wow. Now, they did, Rob, I guess Rob, did take a video of Launchpad doing this sort of virtual reality rescue, helicopter rescue, which I just got today from Rob. Now, I don't know what I can do with it. I have to figure out a way to... It's huge. It's about 500 megabytes, which will like totally blow our media hosting allotment for the month. So if we can figure out what I can do with this to make it available to everybody, I will. But we'll give that a shot. So we want to thank Launchpad Marzari for doing all that great work for us. I know that when you attend an event like this and you're focused on recording interviews and creating content to share with all of you, it really takes a lot of time. And it also honestly detracts from your enjoyment of the event because you're focused on this other thing, recording interviews. So we really, really want to thank Launchpad. He did a great job, I think. I really appreciate it.
And I still want to know, just why did his parents name him Launchpad?
Did we ever get that story? I don't know.
I don't remember.
I don't either.
I don't think so.
We need that story.
I'm sure that... And the kids must have teased him mercifully, you know, unmercifully in school. That's all I can say.
I'm sure.
Yeah, I was really surprised to learn that there were 125 campuses for Embry-Riddle. I didn't realize they were so large.
Yeah, well, they're everywhere. I remember when I was at Pratt & Whitney, there was a little office, a little area, actually in the customer training center, where Pratt & Whitney would train customers who would purchase jet engines. But Embry-Riddle had a little office there, and they made use of some of the conference rooms, the classrooms, I guess I should call them, for teaching students. And it could be for employees or others in the area, I think. So they have those set up in lots and lots of locations. So,
did they do it at night or during the day, or when did they teach the classes?
I think mostly evenings.
Yeah. Yeah, it makes sense. It's a good use of the facility. Why not?
Yeah, for sure.
I always knew them as a place where, you know, some pilots go to get their college degrees. I was surprised a while back to discover that they actually, I believe, graduate more aeronautical engineers per year than any other school in the United States, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. All right, let's do a little bit of what's up with the geeks. I'll kick this one off. First of all, we have something new that we're trying. We wanted to put together a calendar of aviation events, mostly focused on events that represent sort of gatherings of av geeks, places you could go, meetups, things like that, but not exclusively. So we set this calendar function up. You can find it at avgeekfests.com. So that's AVGEEKFESTS www.ecoflight.com, and that'll take you to a calendar of events. We have some in there now. There's a way that you can put your own events into the calendar. So if you're aware of any meetups in your area or aviation-related events where people who enjoy podcasts like this one could go to meet others, have a great time, we encourage you to do that. So that's the first item. Second item, I want to point you to last episode of the UAV Digest that David and I did. This is episode 186. And our guest was Kat Swain. Now, you might have read that AOPA has created a position of Senior Director for UAS Programs. And AOPA is welcoming drone pilots, essentially, into the organization. There are membership options for that category. And we talk with Kat about why AOPA is doing this, what their strategy is, what kinds of value they can provide to drone pilots, but also what kind of value the more traditional membership of AOPA can obtain by having this new group of people come in as well. So if you'd like to learn more about that, visit the uavdigest.com/186, and that'll take you right to the right to that episode. All right. Let's see. What else is going on? Max West, how about you?
Oh, two things. I wanted to follow up on Brian's comment about where on the wing most of the lift is generated. Brian, as you were asking that question, I was thinking about it, kind of laterally, where from left to right along the wing do you get the most lift? But it occurred to me, I do know where you get it kind of from front to back along the chord of a wing, and it's pretty close to it, the leading edge. So typically the greatest pressure differential between high and low pressure on top and bottom of the wing is about 25% of the way back from the leading edge of the wing. And what's really interesting about it is that as the aircraft increases angle of attack, that center of pressure there really remains pretty much unchanged until you start to reach the stall. So that's, for example, I know all my friends in RC modeling, they always check to see that the center of gravity of their airplanes is roughly about 25% back from the leading edge of the wing. So anyway, does that help a little bit?
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't really help me, but it's phenomenally interesting.
So I did send off an email to my good friend Alan Brown, who designed the stealth fighter, the 117, and asked him about the left to right question. Is it more toward the wing root, which is what I'm guessing, and maybe less so toward the wing tip, but I have no idea. So
yeah. And he anyway, should know.
Oh yeah! If he doesn't, it's time for him to retire. No, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure he does. Now, the other thing I just want to mention is, boy, have I been doing a lot of night flying lately. And you might want to ask, well, why now? And the answer is, ta-da, daylight saving time. So, we can't do our night flights until it's after civil twilight, which is about a half hour after a sunset. So, when it gets to be this time of year, I was trying to get most of the night flying in for folks that need to do that for their private pilot's license. So I think I had three flights last week, another one or two this week. So the goal really is to make sure that we're not coming back at midnight, which is what can happen if you do these flights in June or July. Anyway, I posted a great video that I shot of one of my student pilots landing on 30 left at San Jose International. And the lighting is absolutely spectacular. It looks like they have approach lighting, but instead of it being, before you get to the runway, it's actually embedded in the runway because they have a very long displaced threshold. So that's kind of interesting. And then he makes the most gentle touchdown I think I have ever seen. Usually when I film videos, at touchdown, the camera kind of jerks up and down, and it barely moved in my hand as he touched down. So anyway, been having a lot of fun out there at night recently.
So where's that video? Where can we find that?
Oh, go out to Twitter, twitter.com, and look for Max, M-A-X, Trescott, T-R-E-S-C-O-T-T. And while you're there, go ahead and follow me.
Brian, you met an av geek on a flight recently?
Yeah, I did. Actually, a seatmate of mine, as he talked to people sitting next to you, just talk about what you do. And I noticed he was somewhat interested in aviation and just, I mentioned very casually just, hey, by the way, I do this show, because he noticed I know a thing or two about aviation and all. And he's like, I listened to that show. Are you Brian? So it's really funny.
And what did you say? What was your answer?
I was like, nope, not me. Only if you like the show. That's the only way. So I tried to get him to do an interview, and he was a little bit reluctant to do the interview from the airplane. But he said that he'd think about it. So we've exchanged some emails since then, and quite possibly we might come up with a future recording of the, you know, our in-flight encounter. And the other thing that was kind of neat about this flight, we are both 100,000-mile flyers on United, and we both were talking about certain issues that they could improve upon. And it was really great because on this flight, not only did we have an outstanding flight crew, they have actually changed the menu a little bit. And I know it's something really, really small, but we both commented almost at the same moment over the nuts that they were serving, the way that they were actually fresh, and there was a wide variety. It was a mixed nut thing, and there was seasoning on it. They were just really, really good. But just everything went right on this flight. So it was just so funny to be with the listener and share that experience with someone. So,
Cool. I could see it. Max Flight's now booking a flight on United. He loves those nuts.
I know, but are they hot yet? These are still cold, right?
No, they were warmed.
Warmed? I'm in.
So both of us both of us got upgraded. So we were both in first class, and yeah, it was really a nice experience.
Outstanding.
But let me guess, back in economy, the nuts are cold.
Yeah.
What nuts? You get a bag of pretzels if you're lucky.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So the other thing I did, I just wanted to mention, and besides self-gratification, I'm not quite sure why I'm mentioning this, but before the show, I put together a list of the places that I've been this year and the places that I'm going to that I know of up until May. And for anyone new to the show, I get to introduce myself as the frequent flyer of the show. For those of that have listened to the show last year, they know that I said that I was going to try and cut down on my flying this year, and clearly I have failed miserably at that. So far this year, I have been to San Diego, Las Vegas, New York, Washington, D.C., St. Louis, San Francisco, Hawaii, Palm Springs, Orlando, and San Jose. So that's where I've been to so far. Upcoming is Las Vegas, New York, Miami, San Diego, St. Louis, a possible trip to Germany, New York, Chicago, and back to Las Vegas.
Wow. That's about 18 stops there. You're flying way too much, my friend.
This year is, yeah, I said I was going to reduce my flying, and boy, it has not happened and doesn't look like it's going to anytime soon.
I'm thinking that there's an efficiency that we can get here. Why don't we get you your pilot's license, and United can use you to drive the bus as well.
Yeah. I'm all in favor of that.
All right, let's move on. We've got a listener recording from John. He sent us his description of a memorable flight. If you've been listening to the last few episodes, you know that we kind of put out a call for you to send us a description, ideally a recording of a memorable flight from your lifetime. And here's John with his.
Greetings, geeks. A couple episodes back, you asked about memorable flights. I'll follow in Max West and listener Jerry's footsteps and share another cockpit story. The story isn't just about a memorable flight for me, though. It is a story about what may have been the single most influential moment of my life. When I was 11 years old, I had an opportunity to accompany my father on a trip to Poland. The transatlantic leg was from Minneapolis to Amsterdam on a Northwest Airlines 747. As a restless 11-year-old, I asked the flight attendant if I could go see the cockpit. I didn't think she would agree, but she offered to take me up as soon as breakfast service concluded. I finished my breakfast and waited. True to her word, she came by and escorted me to the front of the plane, then up the stairs and into the cockpit. I got to hang out with the three members of the flight crew for what seemed like a long time. They were gracious in answering all my questions and explaining how the plane worked. At one point, the captain even let me sit in a seat as long as I promised not to touch anything. As memorable as all this was, it was the view that I'll really never forget. So we were still over the Atlantic, with the sun starting to rise over Scotland on the horizon. It really was the most magnificent thing I've ever seen in my life. I got home from the trip so excited about aviation. I rode my bike to the library of my small Midwest town and checked out every book they had about aviation. As I exhausted their book supply, I discovered that they had a copy of Microsoft Flight Sim 95 that could be checked out. Maybe the flight simulator would allow me to reproduce what I had seen aloft. The only problem was that my family only owned a Macintosh Classic computer. Microsoft Flight Sim 95 required a PC. I was so enthralled with my cockpit experience that I wouldn't let this deter me. My dad heard that one of his coworkers was getting rid of an old 486. With a handshake, I agreed to mow his yard a couple times in exchange for the old computer. I now had a PC, but it wasn't enough to run Flight Sim. Without other good ideas, I started scouring the neighborhood during garbage day to bring home whatever computer parts I could find sitting on the curb. Eventually, with a lot of trial and error, I figured out enough and collected enough parts to build a PC capable of simulated flight. There I was, lined up at Meg's Field, flying an airplane. The work was worth it. Fast forward 10 years. My interest in computers grew. A few computers and a few versions of Flight Sim later, I found myself at college finishing up a degree in computer engineering. For some reason, being a pilot never seemed like an achievable thing. But I found myself at the university's career fair, nervously trying to get a job. But not just any job. I wanted a job in aviation. So I went to booths from Microsoft and Google and other companies I didn't really care about first, just to make sure I had worked out all the kinks before I moved into the couple aviation companies in attendance. Well, as luck would have it, I was offered an interview, during which I remember peppering the interviewers with aviation questions, much as I had the flight crew of the 747. My GPA wasn't that great, but somehow I got a software engineer job with one of the major avionics companies. The work was worth it. Fast forward another couple years, I finally found myself the means to afford flight lessons. I remember sitting in the left seat of a 172, palms just dripping in sweat as I shut down the engine. The examiner turned to me and asked, "Why do you want to be a pilot?" I shared the story about the moments in the 747 cockpit. With a handshake, I was given my license to learn and became a pilot. My airplane geek status became known at the company. A few years later, I was given the opportunity to manage a software team that uses simulations as a means of creating rapid prototypes for new avionics and flight decks for military aircraft. This brings me to a couple weeks ago. I left work at the end of the week just completely exhausted after spending most of the week sequestered in a room with some of the company's brightest engineers and leaders as we developed the technical proposal to meet the mission needs of an upcoming next-generation aircraft. I drove home exhausted, but couldn't help to be excited about where my life has taken me. And then I wondered where my life might have been if not for that memorable flight nearly 20 years ago. Keep up the good work, geeks. Always like listening to your show.
Wow. Thanks, John. That was brilliantly done. I love it when there's a, you know, an arc, a path or something that's sort of based on this passion for aviation. It's just, I don't know. It just gives me a warm feeling.
Oh, and it starts so early. I'm teaching, I probably mentioned this, a 14-year-old to fly. And his mom just sent me photos of when he was 3 years old, sitting in an airplane with headsets on, and also when he was sitting up in Palo Alto Control Tower, the FAA tower, holding binoculars, you know, to his eyes, looking out the windows.
Wow, how cool.
Yeah. The bug bites early, people.
It does. And, you know, parents and others should watch out for that and nurture it, you know, encourage it when you can. So, again, if you've got a memorable flight, you know, a lot of times we do little little theme things like this, and they kind of run their course, but I don't think we're anywhere close to running the course on this one. So if you've got a memorable flight experience, we'd love for you to just make a little recording. You can use your smartphone, and it'll sound just fine. 5 minutes kind of a thing is a great length to shoot for. Again, thanks to John for doing that. We have one more Launchpad Marzari returns. After Heli Expo, he hot-footed it over to South by Southwest, and he found the EAA booth. Actually, it's something that they call the Spirit of Aviation Mobile Experience. This is something they tour around. So I guess so with his recorder in hand, Launchpad spoke with Tricia Rothermel about this EAA experience that they have. So let's listen to that.
And am I clear on this? Is this a relaunch of Launchpad? Is that what we have here?
This is a Relaunchpad Merzari. That's good.
This is Launchpad Merzari. And hey, we're here at South by Southwest. Now, South by Southwest is known as a big music fair, but we're here in the tech half of it. And guess what we've found? The EAA booth. And I'm here with...
Tricia Rothermel, Trade Show Manager for EAA.
Very cool. Tell us about your exhibit here.
Well, we are here with the Spirit of Aviation Mobile Experience, and this is a 53-foot experiential training and marketing unit that we're using to bring to new audiences.
Okay, and since you brought up audiences, who is your target audience for this event?
Well, we're really here trying to find some new people that want to participate in aviation. So we're looking for that's the reason why we're at non-aviation events. We want to find people who've never thought about aviation, and we want them to look at it differently as a hobby or a career. We just want to open up this experience, this thing that we love, to other people.
Very cool. Now, real quick, walk me through remember where this is radio. Walk me through the different stations we've got.
Absolutely. So we set this up as a little bit of a STEM learning. So we try to include as much as we could of kind of hands-on experiences to give people a look at EAA and also general aviation. So we start out with a virtual reality tour of our museum. It's about a two-minute video that is 360 degrees, makes you feel like you're standing right at the museum at EAA. And then it gives you a little bit of an introduction to what general aviation is, what EAA is, and what we do. Then we move into our workbench area.
And who's the exhibit, your virtual reality? That's hosted by somebody fairly famous.
It is. We actually have Red Bull Air Race pilot and air show pilot. Mike Goulian is our tour guide through that. So it's a really great experience to let people see, you know, a little bit of who we are, but also meet some of the important people that are involved in aviation. So then we move into the trailer where we have these great workbench areas set up. And the idea is to kind of make you feel like you're almost like you're standing in your dad's workshop or, you know, one of those new. But we have a lot of new aspects to it as well. Great multimedia displays over the top that show different aspects of EAA, you know, from anything from AirVenture to Young Eagles to just the general beauty of flight. But the activities that take on the workbench is where the real learning happens. So we have one area that we use aircraft materials to build a cookie cutter. So they get to actually take a piece of aluminum that could be used as an aircraft. It's also food safe, so they can actually go home and use it, and then bend and shape a cookie cutter, actually use a rivet to hold it shut, so they get that whole kind of hands-on feel of what you might do in a workshop when you're working on an airplane, and they get to take a cookie cutter home with you. Cookie cutter is really universal. Anyone can understand what that is, but it gives them that opportunity to get hands-on with aircraft materials and tools.
And they get to say, I pulled a rivet.
Yes, they get to pull a rivet. And they get to take the rivet home with them, so that's a great part. The other activity going on in our workbenches is our gliders, which is actually sponsored by Flight Test. The glider is two or three parts that have to be built together to complete a little airplane. It's called the FT Venture airplane. And that glider, it has a rubber band, you can slingshot it, so you can actually go out and fly it. But it really gives us the opportunity to show the builder the different principles of flight, everything from weight and balance to, you know, how the different components come together. So it gives them a chance. It's a fun activity they can take and play and have fun with, but it also lets them kind of learn a little bit about aviation and flight and through the process.
Cool. And then to get them really hooked.
Yeah, if you're really ready to dive in, we actually have two Redbird flight simulators, both TD, and they give you that chance to land a plane in Oshkosh. That's everyone's dream, right, is to land in Oshkosh. So this gives you a chance to at least do a simulation of it. So you start off in the air, you got to land on the purple dot, but it's a cockpit of a Cessna 172. So it's just like they might experience if they're actually going out and starting that flight training. So hopefully they can get a taste of it there and then, you know, experience enough that they want to go out and do it for real.
And I have a witness. I did it. I landed on the purple dot. I got 100%.
Yes, you did. And you can't forget the best part of our trailer, which is we actually have a replica of the Oshkosh Tower with a long easy and Paul Poresny's P-51 floating above us. They spin and they're in motion. So that's probably the main thing that people come up and they see right away is our rotating planes above our trailer.
Okay, now this is going to air after
South by Southwest is done. So tell me where you're going next.
Well, next we're going to be at Sun and Fun down in Florida. That's our next big stop. But then we're going to be touring around the West or East Coast and up to AirVenture. So if you're going to be at AirVenture, you'll see us there. But check our website, weaa.org/mobile, and you can see the full tour schedule there.
Okay. Well, they've just opened the doors, and you can hear thousands of kids and people streaming in. So it's time to get to work.
Yes, it is.
This is Launchpad Marzari here at South by Southwest. At the EAA booth, frequency change approved. Good day.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. We'll have some links in the show notes where you can learn more about this and see the schedule. As she mentioned, Sun and Fun is next in April and May. They're at Joe Nall Week at Triple Tree Aerodrome in Woodruff, South Carolina. Then they're up to in June, Summerfest in Milwaukee. July, of course, AirVenture. Some other events in August, September, October that you can look for the EAA Spirit of Aviation Mobile Experience. And I also noticed that it's sponsored by NATCA, the National Air Traffic Controllers Association. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, it looks like it's a joint venture there between EAA and NATCA. You know, I think this thing goes way beyond cool. I had seen these stories before, but hadn't really paid much attention to it. As the show was playing, I was searching for photos and looking at it, and my God, this thing is truly amazing.
Yeah.
It reminds me of a flight school in Southern California, which was wildly successful selling demo flights and getting people to learn how to fly. I can't remember how often they did it, but they would take a full-size 172. They had a trailer for it. They would take the wing off of it, and they would trailer it to different shopping malls, and they would spend a week or so at the shopping mall. People would come by, see an airplane inside the mall, which would get their attention, and they would sign up for demo flights. I think going out where the people are makes so much more sense than sitting at the airport waiting for people to show up and say, hey, tell me about flying. This thing is massive, by the way. It's a huge tractor trailer, full-size rig that then expands and opens up when they get on site. My favorite part, besides the part where people can build things inside, is the control tower on top of it. Have you seen that?
No.
Yeah, take a look closely. The first photo I saw, I thought, well, maybe there's a control tower in the background. So I looked for other pictures, and you can see this inside at some convention. And there it is, the control tower right on the top of the unit. So what a really great way to get people involved with aviation. I think, kudos to EAA and NACA for hitting a home run with this one.
Very good. All right, applications for AOPA scholarships.
Yeah, it's that time. I mentioned earlier scholarships from women in aviation. I don't know when that's going to be, but this is right now. And they're talking about, well over $100,000 in scholarships. And now's the time. So you want to go to AOPA.com and figure out how to go ahead and apply. And they might pay a substantial amount of your private pilot license.
Perfect.
I put this in here for Brian, by the way, so that way he can be flying the United aircraft, United Airlines soon.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Great. Happy to help.
Okay, as we wind down, a couple of items in the listener mail section. Brian wrote to us and said, from time to time, you mentioned the Davis-Monthan Air Force Boneyard near Tucson. He says about 30 miles south of there is the Titan Missile Museum. And that's at titanmissilemuseum.org. Brian says, highly recommended. Brian's from Newtown, Australia. And in fact, I have visited that Titan Missile Museum, and I also recommend it. It's if you're out there for the Boneyard or for some of the other things around the museum there, check out the Titan Missile Museum. You get to go down and you can sit in the seats and, push the big red buttons. And it's actually fascinating. So, yeah, thanks to Brian for pointing that out. And then we got an email from Mark. He says that as I was walking back after my last class of the day, I heard two airliners fly overhead. One was an Alaska Airlines 737. I'm not sure what the other one was. He says he didn't see it clearly. What caught my attention was that the sound of the engines was different from usual. The sound was roughly the same volume, but seemed somehow lower in pitch and somehow muted. It says this did not change as they passed over, no Doppler, or not a Doppler effect. The temperature on the ground was 15 to 20 Fahrenheit. Did not know if there was an inversion, though it's common at these temperatures. The planes were presumably on the most common SID from runways 07 left and right, out Pan C. What does that mean, out Pan C? Is that the airport?
It is. That would be an Alaska airport. In fact, the ANC, that's going to be the Anchorage aircraft. So whereas down in the lower 48, airports start with a K, the bigger ones. Up in Alaska, they start with a P.
See, I should have let you do this one. anyway, so he asks, Mark asks, could the weather conditions have been the cause for the sound change? Is there something else that would have this effect? I don't really know the answer to this.
Yeah, I think that is possible. If you had some kind of inversion, the sound may get reflected a little differently off the inversion layer. When we were circulating this among ourselves before the show earlier in the week, I sent an email back to Mark, which said, boy, I use the Plane Finder app. Every time I have a question like that, I whip out the iPhone, open Plane Finder, and boom, it tells me exactly which airline, what model, all that stuff. So I have learned a lot, and I really enjoy that. It's kind of funny. I was down by the Monterey Bay, and I saw a huge contrails up there. I whipped it out and was like, oh, here's an A380 going from Los Angeles to South Korea. So I pulled over, pulled out the zoom lens, got a nice shot of it as it went overhead at 30,000 feet.
Cool.
Nice.
All right. And we heard from Mick, our friend Mick down under. Mick sent us a link to a YouTube video. This is titled 96-year-old World War II pilot takes flight again in Tampa. This is one of those, this makes you feel so good that you just have to go watch this video. So this guy, Bob Brocklehurst, he's 96. And in the war, he flew a P-51 Mustang. So they got him into a Collings Foundation P-51. This was part of the Wings of Freedom tour. And they put him in the back, and off they went. And it says he tested a few of his old tricks. Yes, he got to do the loop. He even did a barrel roll, and he did it with skill. This is a 96-year-old. The volunteer pilot, Brian Norris, his quote was also priceless. He said of this 96-year-old veteran, he said, "He is a rock star. He's a national treasure like the airplane. That's what I told him. I'm flying with a national treasure." So, beautiful story. You got to watch the video, though. I think it's just really delightful.
Yeah, that is so cool.
I know. At 96, this guy is, he's still sharp at 96. Just amazing. It's just amazing.
Something for us all to aspire to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly. He looks like he's having one heck of a good time in the airplane.
Oh, I know.
it's just so awesome. And, you think about it, World War II, 1940 through 45. Yeah, anybody that was flying a P-51 back then is, if they're not gone already, they're well into their 90s. So, these there are fewer and fewer of these fine folks.
That's right. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of the Airplane Geeks podcast. I want to thank all of you for listening. You can find us at airplanegeeks.com. There you'll find links to us on social media, how to contact us, how you can subscribe, all of that sort of thing. If you want to go straight to the show notes for this episode, we've got a lot of links, a lot of the companies, the people that were interviewed and so forth, visit airplanegeeks.com/443. All right. Let's tell folks where they can find us online. Max Trescott, let's start with you.
Well, I already told folks where to find me on Twitter, so I'll mention my flight training site, which is SJ, short for San Jose, sjflight.com. If you're going to be in the Bay Area and you want to fly, give me a holler.
Great. And Brian Coleman, what about you?
Oh, next week I'm going to be in Las Vegas, so I'm not going to be able to record the show with you guys, and I'm going to miss it terribly. But if anyone wants to get a hold of me, their email can go in my backlog at brian@airplanegeeks.com. Oh, wait, let me pull that up. A few weeks ago, I told what the number of backlog is.
And yeah, it's like currently 1,000. Sitting,
it's down to 631.
Yay, keep working at it.
So what's the timeline? So if somebody wants to talk to you in 3 or 4 weeks, they should send an email now?
Maybe
3 or 4 months.
I'm working on it the best I can.
Okay. All right. So plan ahead, folks.
You can find me on Twitter at MaxFlight. Look for me on LinkedIn, also with David Vanderhoof, each Friday on the UAVDigest.com, and with Mary Kirby on the PAXX podcast. Also, you can find me hanging out at the Airplane Geeks listener team on Slack if you want to learn more about how you can participate in that really active little community. Just visit airplanegeeks.com/team, and it'll tell you how to do that. All right, our intro music is by Brother Love. Find him at brotherloverocks.com. Outro by Bruno Massone. You can find his compositions. They incorporate aviation sounds. He works them into the music. It's pretty cool. At brunomassone.com. So please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Fly safely.
Keep the blue side up.
And for David, thanks for listening.
Thanks, Dave. We're thinking about you. We'll be right back.